and the European Commission, they've presented this proposal that there should, by law, be a common charger for mobile phones, tablets and headphones. And the Commission have been wanting to do this for over a decade, saying it would be more convenient for users and it would be better for the environment. And they want the sale of chargers to be what they call decoupled from devices. So basically the charger doesn't have to match the device. And they also propose a harmonised charging port. The biggest opponents of this are Apple. They say that rules forcing connectors to conform to one type could deter innovation, create a mountain of electronic waste and irk customers. Would that irk you, Nikki?
No, it wouldn't irk me really. I don't have this problem particularly. I have at home, I have those wireless charging little pad things. So I just put the phone down on top of them and it charges. So I only have to worry about this when I travel, in the days when you could travel. Remember that? And you needed to take a charger with you to plug into the like hotel wall. I mean, it's probably a good idea to have all the same charger. It would be kind of convenient, but I don't feel particularly strongly about this one.
Don't you? What about you, Eli?
I feel strongly. I think it's such a good idea. I hate having, I've got like the bottom drawer of my clothing drawer, it's just half filled with cables for all these different things, and I just want to chuck them all out. And also, they die, their chargers die so quickly as well, especially the Apple ones, and then you end up buying a cheap alternative because you don't want to pay for the full price version, and that dies within about a week. I've used so many chargers, and every time I thank God, our poor planet.
I agree with you totally. It's like you go through a drawer and you think, what was that for? And you're looking at it and thinking, what did I use that for? But you keep it just in case.
Just in case. Well, something very important that you'll need someday. You won't.
Sometimes they come in handy, but even if you keep them for years, you have boxes of things that have cables in them. So, and we've got multiple devices now, so it would be great just to have one charging cord, wouldn't it?
Oh, it would be nice if when these charging pads get advanced enough that you can just put everything close to it and they charge. That'll be the dream, I think.
You feel sorry for Apple?
No. I think they're doing fine.
No.
I think they can grow up.
When I see that you have to get, you know, your last phone doesn't use that charger, it's like, oh, really? Isn't it?
Yeah, I bought a new MacBook recently, which is like two chargers different than my old one, and then I've read somewhere that the next MacBooks are going to go back again to the old charger. There's just, it's too much. It's so stupid.
That is annoying when they change it on you. I mean, I do agree with that. It's annoying every time you buy a new thing and it's different from the last thing.
What do Apple mean that it would create a mountain of electronic waste, their waste? I mean, what do they
mean?
they must mean that all the ones that
they purposely made exclusive.
Yeah, everyone's just thinking, where do they keep all their cables in their house? Or maybe they're like you, Nikki, and it's not a bother.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I do admit that I have a drawer full of cords and things. I just don't use them because I use the other things.
Mike says a wireless charging dock still has a charger.
That is true, yeah. I just have it plugged in all the time. Yeah.
23 minutes to 5. Well, 64 did seem very old then, didn't it? What do you think about retirement villages, and would you like to live in one? Well, perhaps you already do. There's money in them thar apartments. And in Cambridge, plans are afoot to build a $150 million retirement village with all the bells and whistles, including a memory care centre for residents living with dementia. However, Lawrence Gullery reports in Stuff that demand for low-cost housing for pensioners is high. And he quotes Retirement Villages Association Executive Director John Collins as saying, Waikato will see more retirement villages pop up over the coming years, but operators were starting to offer more choice. Retirement villages pitch prices to be around 75% of the average freehold house, but you have to have a degree of equity to start. It's a bit of an understatement, isn't it? Because That's quite a degree of equity if the average freehold house nationwide is the price is well over 800,000. So we thought we'd ask the question, when did we start living in retirement villages in this country? And there must have been a time when they were few and far between. And joining us now is sociologist and Centre for Research Evaluation and Social Assessment Research Director, Kay Saville-Smith. Kia ora, Kay.
Kia ora. Can I just say that if you're 64 years old, you probably won't get into a retirement village because most of them now will only take 75 plus. So certainly when the Beatles put that out, we did have a few retirement villages in New Zealand. And at that time, and the numbers gathered speed gradually up until the 21st century, actually you would probably get in there at about 50, 55 plus. It was seen as a lifestyle to move out of, if you like, self-managing your own home, really.
Really? So why that age, 75? You know, what is that?
Well, you know, there's lots of issues here that I could say, but I mean, essentially 75-year-olds, they'll be in for a period, but they'll also go out. But the retirement village business model requires people to come in, spend capital, and then leave. And you don't want that leaving too far into the future. You don't want them being in there 25 or 30 years. You want circulation. That's how the business model works.
So if you have
people going there too young, they don't leave in time to make that business model work. And there are only two ways of leaving. Either you buy yourself out, if you like, or you leave and you buy somewhere else, take your money, sell off your ORA, or you die.
It's a euphemism for that, really, isn't it? So I just wanted to ask that question for in terms of New Zealand, and have we always been big on retirement villages? When did they start becoming popular? What years?
Well, I think they really have become more popular over the last 20 years, actually. We've got now about 420-odd retirement villages in New Zealand. In the 1970s, 1890s, you could have probably, well, you'd need quite a few pairs of hands, but you know, it was well under 100. So the rate of development has increased significantly. There's about 47,000 people living in retirement villages. But remember, that's only about 14% of those aged 75 plus. That means 86% of people aged 75 plus are not living in retirement villages.
Do we have the stats about if they're living on their own with a partner, if they're living with their family? Because we wanted to get into this discussion about this communal intergenerational living with younger family members and the benefits and maybe the downsides.
Well, I think a large number of seniors live on their own or with their partners, but there is intergenerational living. Often that's seen as being Māori or Pacific, but actually it is also in other communities as well. The problem is that our dwellings, the way we build our housing stock, doesn't really lead to good intergenerational living. It's hard for people to do that. So they often are a bit overcrowded. So it's not that we need bigger stock, but we need better design stock, and we need to use our land better so families can, intergenerational families can live together. And it can work if they've got good private space and good communal space.
Right, so they're not in each other's pockets, basically. They can go off to their own little space, or you can go off and be a bit separate. Because many people listening to this will have stories about their grandparents or their parents living with them and what the benefits of that, you know, to their well-being was.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, if you're my age, which is now, you know, into my 60s, in my household, when I was young, my grandmother lived with us. And before that, I lived with my grandparents. So it was a great benefit. There was all sorts of, you know, there's a lot of learning. There's a lot of love. There's a lot of interaction, which you miss out if you don't do that. But there can also be tension. So it's like any family. If you have a family that has got some problems in it, intergenerational living might exacerbate that. But if you've got people that get on and can support each other, there's lots of sharing of work. It's a good place for people to be. So there's been a lot of research overseas around this, but we do very little research into intergenerational living in New Zealand.
Even if you don't get on, that can be can teach you a lot, can't it?
Well, yes.
I mean, I don't mean in a very, very serious way, but some bickering, right, or you don't agree on things.
Well, it's like any close living, isn't it? You like flatmates, actually. You learn to treat each other with respect and politeness as a very important part of both intergenerational living and any sharing. And so there are lessons from that. And some people would argue that the tendency to try and live alone reflects that desire not to have to make the compromises, the negotiations, which are just part of everyday life, really.
Yes, many people think, I don't want to live with my children. I want to live by myself. And is that the mindset of us as a nation or individual?
I think there are some tendencies towards that. I think there is very much a view among some seniors that they don't want to be a burden.
Oh, another good point, yes.
Yeah, so they sort of think, well, I have to sort this out for myself and I don't want to, you know, be a burden on my children, so I'll go and do something else. But that's really a sort of view of being a senior, which is really, I think, part of the stigma of old age, where being old is seen as being dependent or not contributing. And that's a very Pākehā thing, actually, and it's something that developed really in the, 40s and 50s, where we became very nuclear family-oriented. You don't get that view necessarily in other cultures, not in the same way. That's not saying that everyone's happy with each other all the time.
You mentioned architecture, but that's not a swift change to, change the architecture of the country. So we had that architecture before the 50s. We had smaller spaces. We made do.
Yeah. Well, we did have smaller spaces. I mean, the irony is we have actually often got a lot bigger. So we've got a lot bigger on the McMansion end and a lot smaller on the apartment end. So we sort of miss this sort of middle thing. But I think one of the things is that we don't use our sites really well. So a lot of older people actually are on big sections, owner-occupiers, and actually subdividing those or having an accessory dwelling unit that they may want to go out to and have their family in the main house or vice versa. All of those things can be done. And actually, there are big yields that can be made from that. You know, we can intensify our city as well just by adding to the sites of our existing dwellings. And so it has huge benefits, I think, for us as a society, the housing market, but also for older people and younger people as well.
Thanks, Kate. Nikki, what's your family like, without getting too personal, but would you like to have your family members come and live with you, intergenerational living?
Well, I would, but I live in a one-bedroom apartment, so that would be pretty tricky. I reckon what I would like would be, say, if my parents lived in the apartment next door to me, for example. I think that kind of co-housing idea is really, really interesting. And I kind of hope that by the time I get to be in my 70s and 80s, that there might be more options along those lines where communities and families get to live together intergenerationally, but in spaces, I think, as Kay's alluded to, that have more that are much more set up for that, so that you have your own private space, but you also have communal space and you get that sense of community together. Because I think it's good for younger people to be with older people, and it's good for older people to be with younger people. It doesn't make sense to me to have a whole lot of old people all living together. I don't know.
And Eli, I believe you went into a shared property arrangement earlier this year, or you were going to. How's that working out? You're all there now. Those are the people who you share that property with, that you're having your dinner?
Yes, I live in a shared flat with we don't own the house though, is that what you mean?
Yes, I thought I heard earlier this year that you were saying that you were purchasing a property.
I do own a house that I don't live in now with two friends, and we did all live there for a while. And now me and my partner are trying to buy our first home, just the two of us. And I gotta say, nothing in our price range is ever gonna have room for a parent to stay in, unfortunately. which is hard, because I think you're right that it's good for older people and younger people to spend time with each other. And it's got me thinking, I'm like, because my parents are both very independent as well, and I don't think they'd want it. But in so many cultures around the world, it's so normal to have, you know, three generations living very close to each other and learning a lot from each other.
And what are your parents like? Would you like to have them living in the next room?
Honestly, I think I would lose the plot, but maybe in the long run it would be good.
Just for Christmas.
Yes, yeah, maybe for a few weeks. I could learn some things and then go back to life with a nice distance between us.
That's the problem, Kay, you see. Thank you very much, Kay.
It's fine, thank you. I look forward to hearing more about people's domestic arrangements.
Yeah, very insightful. That's Kay Saville-Smith. It's 10 minutes to 5. And as reported in the Dominion Post this morning, Wellington City Council has just approved a new cycleway network. It was built. It's going to be built over the next decade. It will spread across 147 km of the city. It's going to cost $226 million. And with just the first two cycleways built, around 160 to 230 car parks are going to be affected. So, is this investment the right one? I'm joined now by Wellington City Councillor Fleur Fitzsimons, who voted for the network. Kia ora, Fleur.
Kia ora.
You voted, it was quite an overwhelming vote though, wasn't it? 14-2?
Yeah, look, there's really strong support around the council table for this, and actually throughout Wellington, because it's really just another step the council can take to make Wellington a better place to live and make cycling around it, you know, easy and safe and fun for people of all ages.
When I saw this story, I wondered, how far are you with the Island Bay Cycleway? It's not going to be modelled on that, is it, or is it?
No, absolutely not. Look, the ghost of Island Bay is still haunting the Wellington City Council, and it's still unresolved. And I'm very conscious that we've got a huge job to rebuild credibility among residents towards the future of cycleways in Wellington. And we have to fix Island Bay before we get started with these very ambitious plans for the rest of the city. It's still sitting there, and it's really challenging the council's social licence to deliver this visionary bike network.
I can imagine. And also with Wellington, it's very hilly, and it's got some very narrow streets. So how's it going to work in that regard? I know you're going to do some modelling in regard to it.
Yeah, look, it's going to need to be a range of different approaches throughout the city. It's not kind of one design for every area. We're going to look at some shared zones. We're going to look at just having some quiet routes. But there will be some separated cycleways and bike paths. What we've just done up the Brooklyn Hill at the moment is quite an interesting example. We put a temporary cycleway up there, and it just used kind of light materials that are a bit more flexible, a bit cheaper. And it just means that we can try it out, see what residents like, see what cyclist feedback is, what the feedback of businesses is, and then change it. And that's certainly the approach that we're going to try and adopt with the rollout of this cycleway network.
Have you had a lot of feedback from Wellingtonians? What do they think?
Yeah, look, there are a range of views in Wellington, as you would expect. There's a lot of passionate people on both sides. But I think what's really interesting about this debate is that you do, when you talk to people about the future they want and what they want Wellington to be in the future for their children and their grandchildren, and you talk about the importance of getting on a bike and the independence that can offer people and the importance of that being safe and, you know, what we want our city to be like to live in the future, a lot of people can see the importance of a connected bike network. We just have to deal with today and tomorrow a bit better. We haven't done that so well in the recent past.
You mean in regard to cycling or the other infrastructure issues?
Well, all of it actually, but particularly in regard to cycling, we've really put the focus on the number of car parks that will be removed, and we've put in really heavy over-engineered solutions that are hard to adjust if they're not working. So, you know, we know that there are a bunch of people who will cycle no matter what. They're not influenced by the kind of nature of the design or the safety features. But there are a whole bunch of other people who would cycle more if the network was safe, if it was well supported, and they really could overcome their hesitancy. And I'm actually in that category myself. And really those are the people we're trying to aim at and make feel safe and secure biking around our city.
Mm. You mean that they're worried about the danger of it, of cycling? Is that the chief worry?
Yeah, look, we have a lot of crashes. We had 56 crashes that were very, very serious in 2020, and that will probably be an underreporting of the actual nature of crashes involving cyclists. And they, you know, that is a failure on us as a city council to have delivered a safe cycling network. And we know that in the future we need to reduce emissions, we need to get people out of cars, we need much more active transport, and really this is an investment in Wellington's future as a city and creating a, you know, a great place to live in the future.
I've got a text here from Phil who lives in Wellington. He says the Brooklyn Cycleway is as much of an abomination as the Island Bay one. I've never seen an actual bike on either of them.
Oh, I've seen plenty of bikes going up there. But I mean,
I haven't seen it. Yeah.
We need to build them so people will come. That is part of the issue.
And he says, I have had continual near misses with pedestrians.
Well, we want to hear Phil's feedback and make sure that we understand where those pinch points are, because that is the point of it, is to actually take into account that feedback from residents and change the design if needed. And there already has been some adjustments to that cycleway.
Nikki, do you cycle?
I do not. I'm like Fleur in the sense that I probably should, and maybe I would, but I don't currently feel that it would be safe for me to cycle around where I live. There's just not the infrastructure there.
Whereabouts do you live?
I'm in the middle of Auckland City.
Oh, you're right, in the heart of it, right?
Yeah, in the CBD. But it's I think it was really interesting to me to read. Did I read this right? That 75% of the cyclists in Wellington currently are men. And that the goal here would be to get more women and, I guess, younger people, children, etc., cycling. And I think that the way to do that obviously is to make it feel safer, to have dedicated cycle lanes. So I'm a fan of that.
75% are men. Why is that? I wonder why that is. I have to. Maybe it's something to do with the seat. Very uncomfortable these days.
No, it's a safety.
I think it would be more
uncomfortable
for men.
Well, yeah, do you think so?
Well, there's more things to get pinched, you know.
I've just, you know, when you go to look at a bike seat, it's just like, why did they change into that very small, narrow thing? I guess none of you can answer that.
I've got a commuter e-bike, and it is a wider, more cushy seat. You know, I think they're out there if you have a look.
That's an e-bike, did you say?
Yeah, commuter e-bike. So it's just for urbanites who just want to get from home to work and ride it easy.
It's a lovely couch seat.
Beautiful bike. Lovely couchy seat, cushy little handles. Don't hurt your hands. You know, everything's made very soft to make it nice and easy for a little chicken like me.
Good. Okay. Fleur, just quickly before you go, how did you get your mayor, Andy Foster, on board? He wasn't for it in the beginning.
No, he was really good to see him supporting going out for consultation. He's always keen to hear what the community think. And it was, I'm really pleased that the mayor of our city is behind this, because it is something we need, you know, a lot of people to get behind in order to see it happen. It's a very ambitious plan, and this is just the beginning. It's going to need constant effort and political support, because we know that introducing cycleway infrastructure can be really controversial, and people have a lot of well-placed fears. We hear from businesses that they're worried about their livelihood being lost if parking goes. And we need to talk to them and hear from them and understand their concerns and try and address them, because we're not going to get very far if we just try and impose it without listening to people.
All right, Fleur. Hey, well, thank you very much for joining us today. Have a good weekend in Wellington.
Thank you very much.
And Veronica says, just walked Brooklyn Hill. Stacks of bikes. Seems fine. That's all we've got time for this afternoon. We're coming up to the news at 5. Nikki Bezant, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Been a pleasure.
And Eli Mathewson, enjoy your weekend and your dinner, Eli.
Yeah, well, take some photos. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, take some photos. And don't forget to put your clocks forward an hour tomorrow night. Daylight saving starts on tomorrow night. Thanks, everyone. News is next, back on Monday.